What's up, everybody? This is episode 4 of Race to the Finish, and I'm here with my friend Chance. So go ahead and introduce yourself, man.
All right. Hi, my name is Chance. I'm a Black Palestinian activist. I go to Kent State, actually. I should be graduating in the summer of 2018 if everything goes right. My degree is in international relations, and I'm hoping to go to law school after for international human rights.
Cool.
Working with Palestinian human rights as well.
Sweet. So, like, I can say, because I, like, just to keep everything transparent to the listeners, obviously, but, like, we've known each other for a while, so, like, I didn't know about your background, like, growing up, like, straight up from, was it high school that we met or something?
Yeah.
So, I mean, like, what, like, got you into this work, like, your activist work?
Okay, when I was in high school and, like, my early years of college, I always thought about, like, how I want to impact people's lives,
yeah,
and how I want to just change the world in my own type of way.
Right.
But I didn't really know how I wanted to do that. I thought, like, maybe becoming a teacher or something like that would be the best way to do it.
Uh-huh.
But after I came to college, I started taking some courses in political science. I had, like, declared my major in international relations. And after that, I got introduced to the Palestinian story.
Okay.
Because before that, I was Palestinian, but I wasn't really in touch with myself or, like, the culture or anything.
Yeah.
So once I started reading history and once I started reading, like, the struggle for Palestinian nationalism, that was really where it took off from there. So I had taken a course. It was just a world politics course, but we had a section in Palestinian nationalism.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was like, this is really cool. I mean, these are, like, my people, you know?
Right.
So
it's kind of like reconnecting and stuff, like, through getting to college.
Yeah, okay. And then even after that, I took, like, a Middle East politics class, and we had an even bigger section on Palestine.
Yeah.
A more in-depth experience.
Okay.
And so then after that, I even took, like, a settler colonial Palestine-Israel course, which was just a whole semester of Palestine and learning history and the various struggles that Palestinians face. So that was kind of just how I got introduced. And then we had a Students for Justice in Palestine chapter on our campus. And so
it's like a student organization.
Yeah, it was a student organization. And so I had started going to the meetings.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the first time that I had, like, seen other Palestinians as in not my dad's friends.
Yeah.
Because growing up in Cleveland Heights, there wasn't any other, like, Arab or Palestinian kids.
Uh-huh.
There was maybe, like, one or two.
Yeah.
Arab kids, like, in general.
Mm-hmm.
I was the only Palestinian kid. So I had literally gone, like, up until college and up until high school with only, like, seeing my family and, like, my family friends.
Yeah.
Those were the only Palestinians, like, I had interacted with. So going to college and seeing this side of, like, Palestine was a lot different for me.
Is it – so I guess I could kind of relate to that too-ish just because, like, in Lorraine, right, there's not so much Salvadorans around me, right? But the Salvadorans that were there just kind of, like – you don't necessarily talk about the issues too much. They're just,
exactly.
It's kind of like family time, you know?
I mean, it's definitely a way to connect.
Right.
But it's not like you have this personal connection to someone because they're El Salvadorian or because they're Palestinian.
Yeah.
But it's not like you're going into the issues of, like, these are the problems that we face, like, in El Salvador. How can we work together to fix it?
Yeah.
Because you're not really meeting on that field.
Uh-huh.
Or, I don't know how you say it, on that kind of environment. You're not meeting on that environment. So it's like these issues don't really come up.
Right.
And of course, like some people are
like I see. I think so. Like you're not necessarily like reflecting on the environment or or what's going on around you so much. Like because like when you're around family, friends, or like even family, like you want to concentrate on one another, not necessarily like on all the negative. And I don't mean negative as in like let's ignore it, but like literally negative effects that could be affecting our community and society and all
that.
And so, but I think that's what college has done for me at least is, because I don't want to speak for you, but like at least for me, like it's allowed me to kind of like dive deeper and kind of uncover a lot of those things, you know, by talking to my peers, you know, people who are also on that journey of kind of reconnecting with their own identities.
Right.
So I kind of want to know, like, what was that moment that it's like, you know what, like I'm actually going to take this jump, reconnect with my identity, and like become a leader, you know? Like when was that moment for you?
So I kind of want to credit it to me taking Arabic. So even though I'm Palestinian, my dad, he's from Gaza. He was born there. He speaks fluent Arabic and English. But growing up, I didn't learn Arabic. So when I came to college, I wanted to start taking courses where I would be able to communicate with my family, like, because I didn't really talk to him that much.
Yeah.
And I would have to go through my father if I wanted to talk to him, kind of like a middleman.
Yeah.
So I started
like interpreting kind of like you're saying something and then he translates and vice versa.
Yeah, because like I literally knew like three phrases in Arabic.
So it's kind of like your second language like around there.
Oh, yeah, yeah, okay. Without a doubt. So I started taking those and that's how I became more interested in just like Arab culture and everything. And then from there it was going into Palestinian, my Palestinian-ness. So after that, and taking the courses and getting involved in SJP, like we were doing like initiatives on campus. We were bringing in speakers. We were hosting events.
You invited me to go to that one.
Yeah,
dude, that was awesome. It really was.
And I actually even served as the president for this school year.
Yeah.
So, I just want to credit like I know maybe he'll listen to this, but Yusuf, he's one of my friends at Kent State.
Okay.
He was actually the president for last year, and he had such a like heavy workload this year because he's a pre-med student and everything that he wasn't going to be able to be president. So when the time came for him to step down, he was like, Chance, like, I want you to try and run for president. You're going to be running up against another guy.
Okay.
One of my other friends, you know.
Yeah.
But, like, we were both committed to the cause. And we were like, no matter who wins, like, I'm going to support you. You're going to support me. Like, you know, like, of course.
Right.
But it was really, like, Yusuf that pushed me to be confident in myself and take on a position of leadership.
Because, it's kind of like a peer mentor almost.
Yeah.
That's dope. That's so cool.
Which is kind of crazy because he's younger than me.
But still, yeah.
But, you know, like, I still looked up to him. He was born in Palestine. He lived there for 14 years, like, most of his life. And so when he came here, he had like a different type of passion about him, which really pushed me to become an activist and to become someone who advocates for other Palestinians. And then it also caused me to self-reflect on myself. So it was like, how can I help people that look like my dad or people who are like my uncle or people who are my aunt who still live in the Gaza Strip right now. And how do I advocate for their human rights? And being in America, I have to use this platform to advocate because they don't have a means to.
Okay.
Yeah. So, I mean, that was a lot of just self-realization in myself. And that's what motivated me towards becoming like a better activist. Because I think I was in touch with a lot of like the politics, that I knew before and that I believe today. I just didn't know how to like articulate them, how to go about them.
I think when it comes to politics and activism, like politics is it ends up being a tool, right? So politics is a reflection of what you personally believe in,
right.
But politics is the mean of trying to get that enacted into power.
Exactly.
So those tools can be like used for good or used for evil. And
right.
So I think what a lot of people get confused with activism, I'm glad you the way you explained it the way you did, is with activism, it's not politics, you know? It's straight up like this is what's right and mm-hmm. we have to move towards that. And so like mentioning your family and stuff and how they don't have the same means you have,
right.
you know, as an American, you know, being in this country and, you know, having the rights that you have, whereas they're still in Gaza, you said, yeah?
Yeah.
With it being as dangerous down there, of course you would have more means to speak up about those issues and advocate for your own family,
exactly.
but also people who are like them as well.
Right. I mean, and there's about 5 million refugees around the world, Palestinian mm-hmm. refugees around the world.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, I really think that we need to give these people a voice, you know?
Yeah.
Like, how can we advocate for them as human beings who are having their rights violated?
Mm-hmm.
So I think it even goes with that as well, you know? Like you said, we have to give a voice to the voiceless.
Yeah, right. And I don't know what it is with – of course I know what it is. It has – So this is my opinion, of course, like it has everything to do with U.S. intervention, right?
Mm-hmm.
So in El Salvador, just a quick in a nutshell, El Salvador, the military was oppressing the poor people in El Salvador, of course, but the military was funded by the United States.
Mm-hmm.
So they were training soldiers, they were providing guns, all this and that. And the poor people, they didn't have the same means as the military to defend themselves. So, of course, Cuba helped them out. The United States used that as an excuse to say, oh, El Salvador is becoming a communist country and we need to do whatever we can to, you know, stop communism, right? So it justified a lot of the violence that they funded,
right?
In their opinion, of course, not my opinion of, quote, justified. But that same – there was a figurehead, and I explained this in the last episode of Romero, like he was a person in power, right? He was – You can say he was a white Salvadoran, right? He was coded as white, like he looks white. He doesn't.
Right.
He might have been mestizo, I don't know. But he was in a position of privilege. But he aligned himself with the indigenous community, or in a community that had a lot of indigenous people and poor people in them, and essentially they dubbed him the name, the voice of the voiceless. So, yeah, like exactly what you said, like. Being the voice of the voiceless with people who are literally dying out there,
right?
You know, like have a risk of dying for actually saying what they need to say.
Mm-hmm.
Like that's something that we face in a different way, but we can also defend our right to say something.
Exactly.
You know, is there like a figurehead, like a Palestinian figurehead that you kind of take after, like look for like inspiration or?
I'm trying to be careful what to say here.
Okay. All right.
I wouldn't say that there's a Palestinian figurehead per se.
Yeah.
Because there's been a lot of political figures that have gone on through the years.
Okay.
And of course, like some have their problems, some don't.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of like Palestinian poets that identify with.
That's cool.
Ghassan Kanafani, Mahmoud Darwish.
Mm-hmm.
Those are just like a couple of them. You can check out their poetry.
Okay, yeah, I'm going to.
But overall, like, I'm more so identified with the movement, I would say.
Yeah.
I wouldn't.
That's the vibe I'm getting.
Yeah, I wouldn't identify it to, like, one specific person.
Mm-hmm.
I think the movement as a whole is just, it's bigger than one person.
Mm-hmm.
So to kind of, like, put that all on the shoulders of, like, one person is a little tough to say. But, I mean, like, I'm not trying to take that away from person in El Salvador. I can't remember his name.
His name is Romero. Like, I just said his last name. But, no, I totally get what you're
like,
saying.
Like, it's a movement. And even if it goes through one person, it's still encapsulating the whole movement, you know?
And I just want to be clear. Like, he wasn't the movement.
Right.
He's essentially the
He's
person.
He's prominent.
He's very prominent. Because he was essentially assassinated. And after he was assassinated, the violence literally, like, ramped up. And so he's only a part of that whole struggle.
Exactly.
Right? Yeah, and so the whole struggle, of course, is what matters, you know? And I think that's what you're trying to articulate.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so tell me – so when you introduced yourself, you said that you were a black Palestinian mm-hmm. activist. So tell me a little about the intersection of being black and Palestinian.
Okay, so
Because that's something I'm like, I really want to know about.
So we actually did an event throughout this semester. It was a Black Palestinian Solidarity event.
Okay.
And actually, like, the National SJP, National Students for Justice in Palestine newsletter, is actually going to be focusing on Black Palestinian Solidarity.
Okay.
So if anyone would want that, like, I could send out that newsletter when it Sweet. Comes out.
Yeah, I mean, as soon as it comes out, I'll put it into, like, the episode notes and stuff.
Right.
It'll be a link, okay. And then, yeah, awesome. People can access it.
But, so, there's been a lot of history between the two communities, the African-American community in the United States
okay.
and the Palestinian community. So, in the 80s, Huey Newton was visiting, like, refugee camps within Lebanon and advocating for Palestinian rights.
Okay.
Saying that Israel needs a retreat to the 67 borders, things like that. And so going into present day, there's like a whole bunch of other stuff, but I'm going to really focus on the present day stuff.
Okay.
So in 2014, when the, I'm going to say Ferguson riot. Yeah, the Ferguson riots. I couldn't remember if it was Ferguson or Baltimore. When the Ferguson riots were going on, Israel was attacking the Gaza Strip,
okay.
or they had just finished. I can't remember the specific timeline in my head right now.
Either way, there was violence around
exactly.
that time.
Exactly. But a lot of the same tactics that the Israeli military was using in the Gaza Strip
uh-huh.
and around Palestine, the United States police were implementing those same tactics.
Interesting.
Yeah. And there's actually a campaign called In the Deadly Exchange
okay.
That goes on in the Palestinian community. And the Deadly Exchange refers to the cross-training of the United States police force, the border police,
mm-hmm.
And other factions of United States law enforcement with the Israeli military and bringing in those same policies that they use on Palestinians into the United States.
Wow.
So I know that the Ohio National Guard cross-trains with the Israeli military.
Wow.
And even the New York Police Department has a facility in Israel.
Hmm.
So those are kind of the same.
The NYPD has a facility in Israel?
Yes.
Wow.
At least that is.
What the heck?
That is,
that's so strange.
Let me actually confirm this
because okay.
I don't want to be on the record saying some wrong stuff.
Okay.
NYPD, police.
In Israel. Well, even if they don't have a department, like, do they actually, like, do you know if they go to the country?
Yeah, I mean, that's where the cross-training happens.
Okay.
So police department opens branch in Kfar Saba with lone detective Charlie Benham. And you could check this out right here if
okay.
you want.
Oh, almost dropped your phone.
But, like, those are the kinds of policies that we need to be aware of.
Oh, my gosh.
So within 2014, like, there was tweets going back and forth between Palestinians and black protesters in America saying, like, hey, if you get tear gas, use milk or Coca-Cola. Don't use water. And just, like, trying to share those kind of support systems between the two groups.
Mm-hmm.
As well as, like, holding up – like, there was a whole bunch of people holding up signs, like saying, like, from Ferguson to Gaza, from Gaza to Ferguson, we stand in solidarity. Mm. And I can pull those up if you want to see them later.
Yeah, yeah.
But I mean, yeah, for the viewers at home,
whatever
they're
you
not
want,
gonna be able to see that.
Whatever you want people to see, like, I'll put it all in the notes and stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
This is all like really really good info.
And then we also have, like, people like the Dream Defenders, so, like, Vic Mensa, Cornell West, mm-hmm. Angela Davis. Vic Mensa actually released a video for his song We Could Be Free, and it takes place in Palestine as well as, like, Charlottesville and Standing Rock to try and bring those communities together and show like the commonalities between those groups.
Mm-hmm.
So then the Dream Defenders, which is like a group of like academics from the Black community, released a statement calling for the release of Ahed Tamimi, who was like a very her case was highly publicized in Palestine and around the world when she ended up hitting a soldier who was trying to come to her house to use her house as a sniper outpost.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so she ended up getting, I think, 9 months in jail for that.
Jeez.
So we have that showing of solidarity between those two groups, the Black community in the United States, as well as the Palestinian community.
Mm.
So those are just a couple commonalities. It's kind of hard for me to elaborate specific facts off the top of my head,
well,
but you know, like,
yeah.
If anyone would be interested, like I have like, we have like the PowerPoint that I did.
Okay.
So yeah.
Okay. So like yourself, you know, like you're dealing with like two different identities, right? And not a lot of people would like put together here in this country. So growing up being Black and Palestinian, like what was that experience like for you? You know, like what are some things that you remember just coming up with those, like, the dual identity?
I mean, like, I think I had a lot of the same backstory that a lot of biracial kids have.
Yeah.
Not just like in America, but I'm sure like around the world.
Uh-huh.
Where it's like, Am I Black or am I Palestinian?
Yeah.
Like, how do I identify?
Like, feeling forced you have to choose a side almost?
Feeling forced into choosing a side, but then when I chose a side, it was almost like I wasn't, like, treated as, like, completely that side, you know?
Oh.
Like, I was always, like, the half-Palestinian kid or the half-Black
mm-hmm.
kid. And I'm not saying that to, like, complain about myself, but that was just a big thing that I had when I was growing up. Like, how do I identify myself?
Mm-hmm.
Because, I mean, like, within the community that I was in, Cleveland Heights, the school that I went to was, like, 80% Black,
mm-hmm.
you know? So, like, I didn't really it was hard for me to, like, identify with, like, all the other Black kids in school because, like, I wasn't completely Black. Like, I didn't grow
mm-hmm.
up with a Black mother and a father. I wasn't, like, a lot of the things that, like, my dad would do weren't, like, the things that we would do, like, in a Black household, you know?
Okay.
So, whereas, like, a lot of the things that my mom would do were the same, like in a Palestinian household, in terms of like her guidance and like things like that.
Yeah.
And like kicking my ass a lot, but you know, it was like, it was just a different dynamic that like I had like grown up with, as compared to like some of my friends who were like completely Palestinian or like completely Black, you know?
Yeah.
So, I mean, and that even reflected like when I had came to college and I started joining SJP. Cause like when I first had gone into SJP, I was like, oh my God, these are like real Palestinian kids, you know? And like, it was like, I had no reason to be nervous, but I was because like, to me, like, I had only seen my dad's friends and, like, to be honest, like, they were a little intimidating on me because I was like, yo, like, I grew up in this community. Like, I'm going to be different, you
mm-hmm.
know? But I think that after, like, I got to know them, I realized that, like, we were more similar than, like, we even thought, you know?
Right.
Like, the experiences that we, like, that they had, like, I could relate to, as well as, like, the experiences that I had, they could relate to as well.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, like, it was just a lot of, like, self-doubt in my head that was, like, superficial.
Yeah.
It wasn't, like, actual tangible differences
yeah.
or I don't know the word right now.
Well, it seems like just going off to college, you know, has done a lot for you in terms of like feeling confident, like in yourself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think it's kind of a similar situation with me because, you know, I was born here, right? I wasn't born in El Salvador, but, you know, I know Spanish, but not like born in the motherland Spanish.
Right.
Like, you know, people are going to look at you differently, you know? Like,
exactly.
You know, here people like look at me and they're like, oh my God, like, where are you from? You know? And, mm-hmm. and just give me that treatment. And I'm like, yo, I'm from Lorraine.
Right.
like I was born here. Like, I'm an American citizen just like you. Like, I'm not, like, I'm of Salvadoran ethnicity or nationality, right?
Right.
But doesn't make me, you know, so much different than someone else who has the same papers as I do.
Right.
So, but the rest of my family friends, like, it is intimidating speaking with them, you know, because they are from El Salvador, right? They've lived through the struggle, and I can't override that with my ignorance, you know?
Right.
So either I'm forced to be humble, right? And I'd rather be humble about it, or I'm asking questions all the time like I'm stupid, but it's because I just genuinely want to know about what's going on.
Right.
You know, but then coming to college, like being surrounded by, luckily enough for me, because there's not many Salvadorans or even Central Americans in Cleveland, you know, there were some people that come here to John Carroll, you know, and I was able to become friends with them, relate with their identity or with their experiences, with their identities, you know, their family stories. It's like, it's almost refreshing, you know?
Right. Yeah.
And so with being Palestinian, you know, like, of course you're black Palestinian. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So what are some other like intersections that you've seen, you know, like other than like black Palestinian, like you see like Hispanic Palestinians, Latinos, like Palestinians or like Asian Palestinians or something like that? Because you mentioned there was a lot of refugees like around the world.
Yeah, there's actually a huge refugee population in Chile.
I read that yesterday.
Yeah, there's a huge Palestinian refugee population there.
Uh huh.
As well as like all over the Middle East and everything.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the first time like me seeing it for myself was when I went to the National Students for Justice in Palestine conference in Houston.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay.
So
how is Houston, by the way?
I mean, it
was cool.
I was at a conference, you know? Like a 3-day conference. But I mean, even within like our Kent campus like community, mm-hmm. the amount of like half Palestinians like myself is like very, very small. Like I think I know maybe one other kid, and I can't remember if this girl is. She might be half Palestinian. Mm. So when I went there, I was meeting so many other, like, people that were, like, half Palestinian. Okay. This guy was like, yo, like, I'm half Lebanese, half Palestinian. I met another girl who was, like, half Lebanese, half Palestinian.
Yeah.
Like, there was a black Palestinian workshop. I mean, so there was just all these other avenues where I was seeing Palestinianness in so many different forms, mm-hmm. you know, based which differed from like the form that I had seen in Kent mm-hmm. or like the form that I had seen like throughout my life in Cleveland, you know. So like I had always heard like, you know, like, oh, this person's like half Palestinian and like half like Mexican or half like some other identity.
Yeah.
But like that was like my first time seeing it, and I was like, oh my God. Like, first of all, I was like, yo, there's like other people like me. Like, you know, like, cause like I was in a place where I was like, yo, like being Cleveland Heights, I was like, I'm like literally like the only person out here, you know? Like and then like when I went to Kent, I was like, oh my God, there's like other people who are like me, you know. But, like, this was, like, another experience, you know? Like, these people have, like, the same, like, probably thought process of being biracial and having those issues in their lives. And to meet them, it was a really amazing experience.
That's cool. Have you been to Palestine before?
No, but I'm actually going to go Probably, I think in the next 2 weeks is my timeline okay. right now.
Yeah.
I'm leaving June 4th.
Sweet.
So, I mean, like, this, if you want to do, like, a before and after kind of
yeah,
thing.
Yeah, no. That's what I was actually thinking about, just because, like, you know, with everything that's going on in the news right mm-hmm. now with a lot of the violence and the killings and stuff that, I mean, it was flooding Twitter and the mainstream yeah. media and stuff. Like,
yeah, I was partly responsible for that, flooding Twitter.
Right. Because seeing a lot of your retweets and stuff. But, mm-hmm. like, you know, I was genuinely concerned. Like I kind of knew, you know, yeah, you did tell me that you're going to Palestine. So I was mm-hmm. concerned. I was like, yo, Chance is going to get yourself. What are you concerned about that, like, when you go down there?
No, I'm not too concerned. I mean, a lot of the things that are going on now are in the Gaza Strip.
Uh-huh.
So
you're going to the West Bank?
I'm going to the West Bank. I'm primarily going to be in a city called Ramallah.
Okay.
Which is kind of like, I don't want to say, like, It has a lot of international aid, like, coming into it.
Okay.
So, I mean, the city is, like, super modern at this point as compared to, like, some of the other cities that are in the West Bank or even, like, in the Gaza Strip. Like, everywhere is pretty impoverished there. But honestly, like, if I could go to Gaza, I would.
Yeah.
Just because, like, that's where, like, my family is from, you know? Like, mm-hmm. I still have family that lives there. That, like, I've never met. So, I mean, like, if I had the opportunity, I would.
Yeah.
Hopefully I do.
Uh-huh.
But, I mean, I'm not really concerned about, like, having any, like, security issues within the West Bank. But the biggest point of concern is, like, going through the airport in Tel Aviv. And
can you talk about that?
Yeah. So the airport is Ben Gurion Airport. It is where you fly into if you have an American passport.
Okay.
Like, not specific to Americans, but people with like a Palestinian identification card, they can't even fly into the Tel Aviv airport. They need to go to Jordan. And then cross over from the bridge in Jordan to get into the West Bank.
Okay.
The same with like.
So people who have Palestinian identification.
It's called it's called a Hawiya.
Okay, so.
It's pretty much like Palestinian citizenship.
Right. So then they have to fly into Jordan and then cross into the West Bank.
Yeah.
So it's very segregated like that. Almost.
Yeah. Okay. And even if you're going into. Gaza, you have to go to Egypt to go into Gaza.
Oh.
You can't go from Israel into Gaza.
Okay.
Like that. Like, you can, but you need, like, a special permit.
Mm-hmm.
But if you have, like, the Palestinian ID, the citizenship, you're not even allowed to fly into the airport.
So how does that work out for you? Because, I mean, you're Palestinian and you have an American passport, I imagine.
Yeah, no. So I just have an American passport. I don't have this identification card.
Okay.
So, like...
So just because you have Palestinian origin doesn't mean you have the identification card.
Right. Okay. So, like I said, I have an American passport. Okay. Like, that's, like, my only citizenship.
Okay.
So when, like, and my dad doesn't either because he's actually coming with me for a little of the trip.
Okay.
So he doesn't have the Palestinian identification because they started implementing the system of Hawiya's, like, electronically and everything like that, like, after he had left Palestine. So... when I go into the airport, it's automatically, like, racial profiling. Like, they're scoping out people with Arab-sounding names, people who look brown, and they're detaining them for a certain number of hours. And
so when you say scoping out, like, they're just walking around and just pulling people from the side, or
they're like, I've had like a couple friends that have went there, and they've told me, like, yeah, as soon as I got off the plane, like, he was like, I was hiding in between like three people, and they were like, yeah, you, like,
Come with me.
Yeah, and they actually have like this room where they put like the people that they're holding, you know, for whatever amount of time.
Uh-huh.
And like it has this name, it's called the Arab Room.
Mm.
Because anyone that looks Arab is going this room, you know?
Yeah.
So after that they're gonna interrogate you. So like, what are you doing in Israel? And they're gonna pull up things like that you have never even heard about yourself, you know, like they're going to be like, so, like, your cousin is Rami, and what Rami just got married. Are you coming for his wedding? Like, things like that. You're like, dude, like, I don't even know who Rami is. Like, so, like, that is, like, one of the struggles that, like, we have to go through as Palestinians, you know?
Yeah.
So just, like, going into this airport and then having all that anxiety of, like, oh, my God, like, are they even going to let me in?
Mm-hmm.
Because, like, there's people who get to the airport, they go to this interrogation room,
mm-hmm.
and like they're like, yo, like we're not giving you a visa, like you're going home.
So it seems like in Israel, like it's pretty evident that they have like almost like I mean, who doesn't, but like a racial society, you know, like those
without a doubt, yeah,
clear white privilege,
mm-hmm.
and all that.
I mean,
it always boggles my mind how some people don't necessarily believe in white privilege, you know.
Yeah, I mean,
because examples like that is just, it's ridiculous to think about, you know, like
just for
looking brown, right, or having like an Arab sounding name,
mm-hmm.
you know, can get you put into a room with a bunch of other people, like you're almost, you know, dehumanized at that point, you
right?
Know? Like, it's kind of frustrating to think about.
I mean, and like that system of dehumanization with Palestinians has been going on for like so long,
uh-huh.
you know. I mean, like, I didn't know when we were going to bring it up, but I mean, like, definitely within the news, like, right now, you know, protesters are being shot.
Yes.
And people are, like,
peaceful protesters are being
shot. And people are blaming them, you know, like,
mm-hmm.
when we're not looking at the people that are shooting, you know, like, so, I mean, like.
It's the thing with, like, this is where, like, nationalism becomes very toxic, right? And it becomes toxic at a much lower level, too, but, like. Stick with me here because I'm going to use Kent as an example. I was thinking about this like actually on my drive here.
Okay.
There's of course that girl that goes to your school, right? That's graduating, that has the, you know, took the picture with the AR and stuff and is so proud and all that. So,
oh my God.
So this is what I've heard from a person that's not you. I want to be clear to the listeners as not Chance who told me this, but another friend that I had that went to Kent that actually lived in the same dorm hall as her. Either her or one of her associates or her friends said that, like, if people during the time of the Kent shootings had guns, you know, people would have had, less people would have died, essentially. But it's like, you ask the question, it's like, wasn't it the National Guard that opened fire? Like, the freaking, a branch of the military, you know? And so, what do you do at that point? You know, how are those people who are going to, quote, fire back at the military be viewed in society? Oh, well, you're a traitor to our country. Those are people who serve. You know, it's like, come on now. And so the military almost have their own privilege when it comes to, like, I mean, killing
impunity.
Protesters.
Yeah.
It's like they are immune to criticism,
mm-hmm.
you know. So the Israeli snipers that are killing these Palestinian protesters, you know, they would never be questioned because everyone's going to give them the excuse, oh, well, they're defending their country. It's their right.
Mm-hmm.
You know, defending against what? Words?
Right. Defending
or even sticks and stones at that point that probably don't even reach them. They're shooting from fire, like so far away, you know. This is what I imagine in my head, but
I mean, like, I don't know. I might have sent you the one video of the guy, like, who is sniping, and then they all cheered, like, after he killed the person.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, that's the type of—
You did send me that.
That's the type of dehumanization I'm talking about, mm-hmm. you know. They're like, oh, my God, what a good snipe. Like—
Right,
not
it's like
this is another
game.
Human being that you just literally took their life.
Right.
Like, and I think that's like one of the things that we need to note when we're looking at Gaza and we're looking at like the humanitarian situation there, that there's 2 million people there, 2 million lives with like 2 million stories, you know? These aren't just like sniper dummies that you're shooting at, you know, these are like my brother, like, this is, like, your cousin. This is, like, your uncle, your dad, your mom.
Mm-hmm.
Like, these are people that, like, you would see, like, on a daily basis. And to have them dehumanized and to have them – their lives just thrown away like that.
Right.
By literally, like, one person is controlling another person's life in that sense.
Right.
And so it's like –
they don't necessarily have a means to free themselves of the oppression that –
exactly.
You know, and that kind of frustrates me too, because there are plenty of people of color and also underrepresented backgrounds that live in this country, right, and look at a lot of people who are impoverished and face violence on many different levels.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll point to it as like, pull yourselves up by your bootstraps, right? You know, you need to escape yourself. You got to do everything that you can. Well, I mean – if you study society, right, and even just paying attention, you don't even have to study it, but just pay attention, critically pay attention to society, you know that there's things around people that affect their outcomes.
Right.
You know, the environment strictly, like affects the choices that they're going to make anyways, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they have free will to make the choices that they want based upon their environment. So if we look at Palestine, you know, the protesters that are out there, like, trying to free themselves of this violent oppression that they're living every single day. How can they free themselves if literally, like, Israeli soldiers are just playing Call of Duty essentially out there?
Mm-hmm.
You know, just because it seems like they want to have fun. Or,
right.
that's the impression that I get from watching those videos on Twitter and stuff that are just – that they're just plainly put out there, you know?
I mean, even that, like, to go further into that, like, Gaza has been under 11 years of siege, you know, like a blockade has been going around Gaza for 11 years, you know? So they're not getting, like, infrastructure. They're not getting electricity. They're not getting, water. 97% of the water in Gaza is undrinkable.
And blockade is imposed by Israel?
Yeah. Like, so in 1993, there was, like, these peace agreements called the Oslo Accords that, like...
I heard.
Yeah, that didn't really do anything.
Yeah.
But, sorry if you like the Oslo Accords. But, they established, like... This is just one example, okay?
Okay.
They established that Palestinian fishers would be able to fish 20 miles out.
Okay.
And now, because of the blockade, if they go more than 3 nautical miles, they're going to get shot up by Israeli warships. So
like, why the blockade? Like, do they just want to cripple society just so they can take the land for themselves or something? Like, what is the strategy there by just having that blockade?
So, in terms of land, it's a little bit different than the West Bank because, I mean, like, the West Bank has all these, like, historical and religious significance to it.
Okay.
Whereas, like, Gaza, like, there's a lot more resistance and, like, pushback against, like, occupation, you know, because the standard of living in Gaza isn't near the standard of living in the West Bank. And I'm not saying that, like, the West Bank is, like, a good place to live now,
yeah.
But, you know, like, you're at the bottom of the barrel in the West Bank, and then you're even under the barrel in Gaza. Yeah. So, I mean, like, when it comes to that, we see that I'm going to get into, like, Palestinian history right now.
Go ahead.
So, like, in 2006, like, the Palestinians had elections in the West Bank and in Gaza.
Okay.
And so the West Bank chose a branch called Fatah to represent themselves. It was, like, the like, popular standard, like, organization, whereas the people of Gaza chose, like, Hamas.
Okay.
To, like, so they were, like, officially elected and were chosen to represent, like, the people of Gaza. In parliamentary elections, they won, like, an established majority in the Gaza Strip.
Okay.
And so, like, after that, to pretty much strong arm, like, Gaza into, like, relinquishing, like, control of the Gaza Strip, Israel put this blockade the following year. So in 2006, they become elected. 2007, they're having this blockade.
Okay.
And this even came after, in 2005, Israel actually pulled out all their settlers from Gaza. So there's about 5,000 settlers in Gaza, and they pulled those people out.
Huh.
Which, when it happened, it wasn't like a, like when disengagement happened in 2005, it wasn't a good thing because they were like, we're going to leave Gaza to the Palestinians. But they were like still like the occupying force, you know? So it's not like Gaza had independent markets and independent economy or anything like that. So when they pulled out, they took the economy with them. And so now the unemployment rate in Gaza is 42%, which is like the highest in the world.
Oh, my gosh.
And it's as high as 58% among youth. Yeah.
So that's nearly half of society.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
So literally, like, you're working and I'm not. And imagine, like, going down the street and every other person pretty much our age is like that.
Wow.
So people who are graduating from college, like, because obviously there's still people going to school and things like that and living lives.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, where do you work after that?
Uh-huh.
Like, what are you doing? So after they imposed, like, the siege in 2007 as a way to strong-arm Gaza into relinquishing control of the Gaza Strip because Gaza was – sorry, Hamas was they're deemed, like, a terrorist organization by Israel, the United States, and the European Union.
Okay.
So they were like, we're not going to work with terrorists. Like, I don't care if they were, like, elected by the people of Gaza. Like, what do those people know? you know, like, they're just Palestinians. So Israel was like, we're not going to work with them. And even the European Union, who was supposed to be watching the border crossing between Egypt and Gaza, I think it was, like, the movement – some kind of movements agreement, they were like, yo, we're not going to be facilitating this border anymore because, like, we're not going to cooperate with Hamas. Like, when they get rid of Hamas, like, we can go in. But, like, the point of the matter is this was collective punishment for the 2 million people who live in Gaza. Like, Hamas doesn't represent everyone in the Gaza Strip. Just, like... like, we would say that Trump doesn't represent every American that's out here.
Yeah.
You know, so why are every Palestinian, every one of those 2 million Palestinians in the Gaza Strip being collectively punished for the actions of Hamas, you know?
Yeah.
Who is, like, the elected governmental body. Because even after they were doing, like, terrorist stuff, within, like, the 90s and the early 2000s, like, they had kind of, like, reformed themselves into a political, like, a political movement with a paramilitary branch.
Okay.
And that is why, like, there's the siege where, like, Israel is even counting the number of calories that are going into Gaza every day.
Really?
Yes. And there's
calories.
Calories. So, like, they're getting, like, 2,254 or 2,754, something like that. Between, like, the daily intake that you need is allotted to each Palestinian to ensure that, like, there's, like, hunger, but no one's dying, you know?
Yeah.
Like, there's not, like, starvation. And this is quoted from an Israeli minister saying, sometimes you need to put the population on a diet, you know? And that was in response to, like, that was at the beginning of the siege. And so even now, like, as a result of the three wars that have gone on within the past, like, 10 years, not even wars, the assaults on Gaza, a lot of the infrastructure there is destroyed, you know?
Yeah.
Like, Israel is bombing power plants. They're bombing sewage lines, like where like there's 29 million gallons of sewage going into the sea every day. You know,
it's just like eliminating life resources needed for life.
Exactly. And even the United Nations had said that Gaza is de-developing so fast that it's going to be unlivable by 2020.
That's crazy. Yeah. 2 years.
That's a UN report.
It's a year and a half away.
Exactly.
That's crazy. Yeah, and we all know what, you know, some countries do with UN reports either. They just ignore them, really.
Right. And I mean, like, that's kind of like Israel's thing, you know? Like, there's so many resolutions passed in the General Assembly condemning, like, settlements or even in the United Nations Security Council, like, advocating for independent studies into the deaths of the people in Gaza right now, where the United States has just blocked them on the behalf of Israel.
Yeah.
So we can't get independent investigations because of the United States' complicity in this. And I mean, the United States has said that they are committed to peace on both sides, you know?
Right.
But even then, like, just this past week during the assembly, the United Nations assembly, when the Palestinian envoy was talking, Nikki Haley, the United States ambassador, left when the Palestinian envoy started to speak, you know? Mm. Like, how could you claim to represent both sides when you won't even listen to a Palestinian voice talk about the things that are going on in their country right now, you know?
Yeah. So on that note, I kind of want to bring it back to Chance, but also like keep this, you know, topic of Palestine, you know,
out
there.
Of course. Sorry if I've like,
no, dude,
diverted.
You're good.
Yeah.
No, this is all good. But like, just kind of wrapping up the episode, like what's something that you want, you know, as a leader, as a Black Palestinian, as Chance, what do you want to tell society? Like, what do you want to tell the world? You know, what's something that's been on your mind?
I would definitely say, like, we all need to be activists, you know, because activism isn't just, like you said, it isn't just politics. It's standing up for what's right.
Mm-hmm.
Like, people that are protesting shouldn't be shot. We all agree to that. And everyone has a right to do that. So why are we not trying to protect the rights of people who live in every society around the world, you know? Why, like, I want to be able to come to a LASA event and not advocate, but support your community. And I want you to come to mind just like you did when you came to, like, our culture night, you know?
For sure.
Like, I think that we need a lot more intersectionality and to see that, like, all these issues are connected in a, like, a bigger bridge, you know? And through that, I think that activism is really important in helping us find those connections.
Cool. All right, Chance. I want to thank you for so much for coming on the show.
Yeah,
like, seriously, like,
thanks.
I've learned so much, like, just in this hour.
Thanks for having me, man. Like,
all right.
Hopefully I can come back sometime, you know, talk about my experiences.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And then, you know, the resources that you wanted to share, like, I just wanted to repeat that they will be on the show notes for all the listeners, you know, for them to read up, you know, like, become familiar with, like, what's going on, not necessarily just in this country, but the violence that exists outside of the country that this country is very much involved with.
Yeah.
All right.
Thank you.
Cool. All right. So we'll see you in for another episode when you come back from Palestine. I hope you stay safe and you really excel, like, in everything that you do over there. All right.
Thank you. Thank you.
Cool. Appreciate all right. It. Tune in, everybody, for the next episode. What is it? A week, whenever this one comes out. After this one comes out. All right. I'll see you guys. Goodbye.